Well, good morning to everybody, and thank you for being willing to participate in our remote arguments this morning. Before we begin, I want to make sure that you understand that we know that sometimes because we're appearing remotely, there are unexpected glitches or interruptions. We'll do our best to keep those to a minimum and ask you to do the same during our conversation. The only other thing I would say is if you could please state your name before you begin. And why don't we go ahead and call the first case?
All right, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding, calling case A19-1575, Robinson versus Metropolitan Council.
Good morning, counsel, and Mr. Brandingham, on behalf of appellants. Go ahead, you may proceed.
Great, thank you, Your Honor. Jeremy Brandingham, representing James Robinson, the appellant. In summary, let's just go through a quick timeline. On March 29, 2019, the jury awarded the appellant $1,537.17 for his past medical expense. Then on April 3rd, 2019, the district court issued an order of for judgment reducing the verdict to zero because the appellant had not met a tort threshold under 65B.51 subdivision 3. We filed a motion with the district court for reconsideration because tort thresholds do not apply to special damages, just general damages. On June 10th, 2019, respondent sent a check. Sorry, I lost contact for a second. On June 10, 2019, respondent sent a check to appellant for the $1,537.17. And then on August 1st, 2019, the district court issued an order denying appellant's motion for reconsideration, stating that the jury award was now being reduced to zero because respondent had paid appellant the $1,537.17 for the medical expenses. We appealed then to the appellate court because under statute 548.251 subdivision 1, collateral source offsets are applied only for payments made up to the date of the verdict. And in this case, the payment that we received from respondent was made 2.5 months after the trial or the verdict. In respondent's brief, they argue that even if the district court did err in applying the tort threshold to the medical damages and the district court erred in applying the collateral source offsets to payments made after the verdict, there's still a question about who is in fact the prevailing party. And I think the case of Orchard versus Maloney, it's 581 Northwest 2nd, 838, that Minnesota Supreme Court case, deals directly with the issue of who is a prevailing party in a case like this. In that case, it was a car accident case just like this. And then the plaintiff tried that case. There was a $10,000 Rule 68 offer from the defendant. The jury came in with an award with a net verdict or net amount to the plaintiff in that case of $4,502.40. So they actually got less than the defendant's Rule 68 $10,000 offer. But the court said that the plaintiff in that case was still the prevailing party and entitled to their cost because—
Mr. Brandingham, if I could jump in, because this is one of the questions I had for both parties as I read the submissions. Can you tell me what your understanding is about Rule 68? I guess I was always under the impression that Rule 68 isn't something you look to when deciding who is the prevailing party, that you decide who the prevailing party is first, and then you apply Rule 68 to determine, what, if any, costs and disbursements would be included.
Yeah, and I agree with your understanding of Rule 68. So the prevailing party is the person who prevails under the underlying claim. Rule 68 will change then the effect of how the costs are distributed after the decision is made. If the defendant has a Rule 68 and then the verdict comes in obviously under their Rule 68, then they get their costs. But as I was saying with the case I was just citing, my understanding is the Supreme Court of Minnesota is basically saying that doesn't mean the plaintiff is not entitled to their costs just because the defendant gets their costs. So in that case, both parties were entitled to their costs because the Supreme Court said that the plaintiff was still the prevailing party because they won on the underlying action.
So what do you think the claim is here that we should be looking at in reviewing the district court's determination of who the prevailing party is?
Well, I think in this case, the district court just made a mistake in those two areas I talked about, basically, you know, applying tort thresholds to special damages and then doing an offset for payments made after the verdict. The district court in this case awarded cost to the defendant, the respondent, because the court obviously determined that they were the prevailing party because my client got a net zero verdict.
Right.
Based on-
let me stop you because my question was a little bit different. I understand what the district court did, and I think I understand the two arguments you're making about the threshold and what the meaning of paid or payable is. My question is a little bit broader, I think, and that is, what was your claim? If we're looking at the prevailing party and we're comparing a jury verdict to what the claim was to determine who the prevailing party is, what was the claim that you brought?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, my client was a passenger on a bus that was hit by a vehicle. And my client claimed that he was injured as a result of this collision with the car. And so he had some soft tissue injuries. He ended up doing some chiropractic care. So the claim was, one, that he was injured as a result of this accident, and two, that the treatment he received was related to his injuries from the accident.
But the claim was that he was permanently injured.
Well, that was part of the claim. When you bring a personal injury action like this, then there, you know, we were asking for pain and suffering as well, not just the specials, but the actual general damages as well. And in order to get general damages, then obviously you have to meet one of those four requirements, tort thresholds, and one of those is permanent injury. So I believe in this case, the chiropractor had opined that my client had been permanently injured as a result of this accident, but
So getting right to as I see part of the thick of this issue is trying to quantify, if you can, the portion of the claim that relates to general damages or pain and suffering versus the portion that related to medical expenses.
Right. Yeah, there was no award for general damages in this case. So.
Right, but in terms of the claim, I understand there was no award. So we know that was, if you're trying to determine, and we oversimplify it by talking about prevailing party, but wins and losses or who prevailed on a particular part, you're not saying that that you or Mr. Robertson prevailed on the general damages, right? That certainly is something that you did not prevail on. So I'm trying to compare what respondents prevailed on versus what you, I think, indisputably might have prevailed on, the economic damages, the medical expenses.
Yes, I mean, I agree. We did not prevail on every aspect of the case. So, and I'm sure in the Borchardt case, the plaintiff did not prevail in every aspect of that case either, you know, but we did prevail in the underlying claim that the jury did find that my client was hurt in the accident and the treatment was, part of the treatment was related. So I think that is...
Right, but I'm asking you to take that next step and to weigh the two parts of your claim. And tell me, which one do you think was the more important or substantial portion? The portion that resulted in the 153717 verdict, or the portion that resulted in an adverse verdict?
Yeah, I don't know how you'd weigh that. I mean, if I wanted to, let's say, you know, going into this, I think we did a Rule 68 for 4,000. They did a Rule 68 for 500. So it's hard to know exactly how you'd weigh a victory then if there's many elements to the case. Maybe I wanted 100,000 and I, you know, my cost and time is worth something. So then how would I factor that in terms of a victory? Even if they would have given me $5,000 for my client, you know, is that really a victory when you add in all my time and costs and what the client went through? So I think the rule is if you surpass $100, then essentially under statute, you've succeeded in the action. It is kind of the analysis you're looking at would, you know, be very hard to quantify who the winner is if you're weighing different things like that.
But so is your argument that all we look at is if you get any award at all, then you're the prevailing party? Or what is the test that you're, what are the standards?
I think there was a case that was cited by the respondent, that Luna case, Luna versus Zeeb. And in that case, the appeals court basically said, you know, she ended up with a zero net verdict. So if you take offsets, then it was a zero net verdict. So I think that would be an example where, you know, there was an award in that case by the jury, but with offsets, then she ended up with zero. And so she was not, my understanding is that she would not be the prevailing party in a case like that.
Let me ask you a couple of specific questions, Mr. Brenningham. First, what is the precise rule of law that you would suggest we apply to reach your preferred determination as to prevailing party status? And second, assuming that we agree with you, what is the precise instruction we would give to the district court on any remand regarding the judgment?
Well, precise rule of law, I think following a Borchardt case, excuse me, I have some safety people going by.
They're not coming. They're not coming for you, are they?
Hopefully. Following the Borchardt case, I think the standard is that when there's a dispute in a personal injury action like this, and you're making claims for injury, and a jury finds that yes, you were in fact injured from the accident, then you're the prevailing party. Then I guess what kicks in would be the analysis under the Luna case, which is, all right, so they say you're injured, then the next prong would be, you know, what does that mean in terms of financially? Are you getting a net zero even though they said you were injured? And it sounds like based on that analysis, then if that's a net zero verdict, then no, you're not the prevailing party, even though they did say you were in fact injured. But if one, they say you were injured, and two, you end up with money from the verdict after offset, then you are the prevailing party. That's my understanding. So
Mr. Brenningham, in this case, there's a jury verdict and then there's a judgment and there's a difference between the amounts, right? Are you saying that it's error for a district court to look at the judgment in deciding prevailing party, that the district court is confined to look at the verdict and exclude the judgment amount when deciding who the prevailing party is?
Yeah, I think if you tell the district court that they can sort of apply a subjective analysis about who prevailing party is, they can weigh all these different things I don't even know about.
But that's not my question. I do think that they have a lot of discretion, and some of those factors would be subjective in deciding who the prevailing party is. And they also have discretion to say no one prevailed. But my question, based on your answer to Judge Ross's question, is it proper for a district court to consider the judgment amount, assuming that there's a difference between the verdict and the judgment amount? What's a court supposed to look at to determine prevailing party? Are you saying it's error to consider the judgment amount, that they're confined to only look at the verdict amount?
Well, I'm a little confused by the question. So when in this case, the verdict amount and the judgment amount are the same. The jury awarded the $1,537.17. And then the amount my client received was the $1,537.17. So there was no offset in this case. The judge mistakenly did an offset, but the respondent paid the amount that was awarded anyway, even though the judge said they didn't have to pay anything. So I guess I don't know how to answer the question. So,
if I could, Judge Brian, just one quick follow-up. Mr. Renningham, I had a second part to my question, and I don't think you got to it, which is, assuming we rule in your favor, what is the specific instruction you would ask us to direct the district court to do on remand?
Yes, Your Honor. So I would request that the court instruct the district court to amend what they've done and say that my client was entitled, based on the verdict, to the amount that's already been paid, the $1,537.17, and that my client is entitled to costs as a result of that verdict. I think had the judge realized that my client was entitled to the $1,537.17, then the judge would have given us our cost. So just as far as general instructions, I would just tell district courts that, if you have a plaintiff who gets a verdict, then it's not a zero verdict, and it's more than the Rule 68 offer from defendant, then they are the prevailing party. I guess
that's sort of the rule of law that you're asking us to apply, and what you said just before then would be the specific instruction, I think. I think I understand your argument better now.
Thank you. Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Brendel, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the fundamental concept which we're dealing with in this case is whether Rule 68 and the analysis of Borchert versus Maloney are mutually exclusive to one another, as you seem to suggest with your question, Judge Brian. And I think the answer to that is no, they are not mutually exclusive to one another. And Borchert versus Maloney, I think it's important to recognize, as a 1988 Minnesota Supreme Court case, which has been cited many, many, many times, I think almost 100 times since 1980, even after the inception of Rule 68. Therefore, I think it's important that the analysis of Borchert versus Maloney can apply to any district court proceeding, even after the application of Rule 68 has been conducted by the court. In this particular case, I think it's also important to recognize that with respect to the analysis as to the, quote, prevailing party, unquote, which seems to be the operative language at issue in this particular appeal, is that the appellant, Mr. Robinson, was awarded less than 16% of the medical expenses he sought in the jury trial. Therefore, as I suggest in my alternative relief which the court may grant, it's important that the district court be allowed to conduct an analysis with respect to the issue of who, in fact, was the prevailing party in the action. And those are all considerations which are necessary to make that determination. And in particular, it's important, once again, as you point out, Judge Brian, that the verdict for general damages, which of course is the supposition behind 65B.51, is that general damages are not awardable in the event one of the thresholds under the statute is not met. In this particular case, the general damages were zero, both past and future. And again, the complaint, as you suggest, Judge Brian, did pray for general damages for pain, disability, and emotional distress, which of course was one of the special interrogatories on the verdict form. Therefore, with respect to that particular issue, which is part of the essence of the uninsured motorist claim brought by the appellant plaintiff, Mr. Robinson, the Metropolitan Council, my client, was clearly the prevailing party. Therefore, the court should be allowed in its discretion to determine who is entitled to costs and in what amount. I will concede for purposes of this argument that if the court should determine based upon submissions from the plaintiff at the time of the post-trial motions that the plaintiff was in fact a, and I hesitate to use the term prevailing party because I don't know that Rule 68 necessarily determines who is a prevailing party. I think Rule 68 is limited to a determination as to who is entitled to costs based upon a particular settlement offer. In this particular case, as the court is aware, the plaintiff had submitted a $4,000 Rule 68 settlement offer, and the Metropolitan Council, my client, had submitted a corresponding offer of $500. Clearly, the plaintiff exceeded the $500 offer if, in fact, the court determines that the set-off applied by the court for paid or payable under the Rule 68 analysis, then it was reduced to zero. But if, in fact, the court determines that the $1,537.17 was a just award, then obviously the verdict exceeds the $500 offer made by my client. However, I think it's important to recognize that there were two separate motions, one of which was considered an informal motion, presumably pursuant to Rule 60, immediately after the court entered its order for judgment, pursuant to its findings of fact and conclusions of law. At that time, the plaintiff had an opportunity to submit to the court evidence which would support his position that these medical expenses were neither paid nor payable pursuant to Rule 68. He did not submit any such evidence. There is no affidavit accompanying.
What's the specific fact that you think is missing from the record that needs to be included in order for the district court to consider that argument?
Well, at the time the informal Rule 60 motion was submitted to the court, there was no suggestion that the Metropolitan Council had refused to pay no-fault benefits.
Well, other than the trial itself.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the fact that no-fault benefits may be available to the plaintiff and that the plaintiff may be seeking the same benefits at trial is not, those are not precluded by one another. In other words, there is case law which allows plaintiffs and claimants under the No-Fault Act to double dip, as it were. So in this particular case, the submission of evidence to the Court of Appeals, which was not included in either of the post-trial motions, Those two motions being the informal right. rule.
But the fact, the piece of evidence that you're saying was submitted just to the Court of Appeals is the fact of denying benefits.
Correct. Okay. That was never part of the trial court record. And as I pointed out in that and in the submissions in my brief, the case of Ambank of St. Paul versus St. Paul Coating and Specialties, and I quote directly from that opinion, motions for reconsideration are not opportunities to present facts that were available when the prior motion was considered and will not be allowed to supplement the record on appeal, end quote. In this particular case, the record from the two previous post-trial motions, including the motion for reconsideration, didn't include any of that evidence. And so the district court cannot make those determinations in a vacuum, and I submit that it was the plaintiff's responsibility to submit evidence that the court's ruling was incorrect. Otherwise, the court had no basis upon which to reverse its order for judgment. And I also believe the court is correct in pointing out that the verdict is not the only consideration. The order for judgment has to be taken into consideration here. And the order for judgment in this case was that the plaintiff's cause of action be dismissed with prejudice. And therefore, in order to reverse that ruling pursuant to the rules of civil procedure, particularly Rule 115.11, in as much as the plaintiff submitted that request for reconsideration, it is the plaintiff's responsibility to present an affidavit or other evidence which would allow the district court to make a determination as to whether its previous ruling was incorrect. And in this case, that evidence was never provided to the district court.
Mr. Brindell, can you quantify for me what is at stake here? If we were to rule against you in favor of Mr. Robinson as to relief from the judgment, and you end up back in district court on your suggestion that the district court then have an opportunity to determine who the prevailing party is and indicate that there are costs and disbursements, what's the ballpark range that we're looking at as a consequence of our decision against you if we were to rule that way?
Well, my client has expended thousands of dollars in costs, Judge Ross, defending this particular case. And the fundamental principle that I am trying to articulate, and probably inartfully here, is whether someone should be allowed to pursue a case like this in which he seeks multiple thousands of dollars for medical specials and other specials, and also general damages, and is awarded nothing for the general damages and a mere fraction of what he pleads in his cause of action for special damages, and whether it is fundamentally equitable for my client to have to absorb those thousands of dollars of costs in defending this type of case when the plaintiff succeeds on proof to a finder of fact of only 15% of his special damages and is completely shut out with respect to the others.
Well, let me stop you there because I had a question about that too. Is it fundamentally fair to, if we adopted your interpretation of what paid and payable means, is it fundamentally fair to allow defendants to go through a jury trial and at the end, once you get a verdict, write a check and then claim to be the prevailing party? Is that fundamentally fair?
No, Your Honor, and I will concede to you that the court in this particular case likely erred in determining that the amount of award for special damages should be deducted. I will concede that. And but again, if in fact the plaintiff is determined to have prevailed under the Rule 68 analysis, that does not preclude my client from seeking his costs or its costs and disbursements as a prevailing party in the matter pursuant to a Borchert v. Maloney analysis. And so I don't dispute what you are suggesting, Your Honor, and I am certainly willing to concede that if the court believes that there was sufficient proof provided to the district court to overturn its order for judgment based upon an erroneous interpretation of the special damages awarded and the effect it had on the verdict, then I don't have any problem with that. But it still remains a fact that my client, at least in my considered opinion, was a prevailing party with respect to at least some of the issues in the case.
Right, but you're saying those are the arguments you then bring to the district court.
Right, and that's another point which I think is well taken, Your Honor. This is a case which should likely be remanded to the district court for further proceedings because no proceeding for costs and disbursements has ever been heard, nor brought before the district court to make a determination as to who in fact could be the prevailing party in light of the attendant circumstances of the case. So, you know, my suggestion, I think in the last part of my brief, that the case be remanded to the district court for further proceedings to make those determinations is probably the most likely and fair in the interest of justice that the Court of Appeals can administer here.
I appreciate your candor and willingness to concede points. Sometimes we see attorneys who don't take that approach. So I appreciate that. The question I have is after reviewing the briefs, especially the Leonardson case, which does seem to suggest that the sequence of payment versus the timing of the jury verdict is really important in determining what the meaning of paid or payable means. It seems that Mr. Brenningham is correct to suggest that Leonardson, the proposition that the Supreme Court handed down in Leonardson is that that paid or payable means up until the time of the jury verdict. If that's the case, are you also conceding that Leonardson would require us to reverse the district court's decision to deduct the amount of money? Again, assuming that that's a proper within our scope of review, that that argument is proper.
Yes. Again, Your Honor, I would point you to the fact that there were two post-trial motions, neither of which included a submission of any evidence concerning whether those amounts were paid or payable. Factually now, since I have learned after the trial, since I did not have access to the no-fault file before or during the trial, and it was only afterwards that I became aware that the no-fault claim had been denied. And that is why, had that been brought to the court's attention at the time of the post-trial motions, the outcome may have been different. But my client did submit payment in the amount of $1,537.17. And I think the letter was provided as part of the record in this case. That was espoused by the claim rep at the Metropolitan Council to be for no-fault benefits. Because if the court will recall, from the submission of the extraneous evidence, which was not included in the original record at the trial court level, my client had apparently denied payment of no-fault benefits before the Supreme Court determined that Metropolitan Council transit buses were motor vehicles and subject to the no-fault law. So the denial of the benefits came before the Supreme Court made that determination. So I don't know that that necessarily changes the legal analysis, but that is a fact that does come into play here. And that it's also important then to recognize that my client maintained an open no-fault file throughout the time frame after the decision was made by the Supreme Court that the no-fault law did apply to the Metro Transit bus system. I believe I'm out of time, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brenningham.
Just reading it there, Your Honor. So counsel said that we had an opportunity to let the district court know about the offsets. I will want to point out that one, the way the system's set up is that it's the defendant that has 10 days to present the court with information about collateral source offset. When the judge issued his order originally, it had nothing to do with the offset. It had to do with the tort threshold issue. And so we let the court know that that was a misapplication. When the judge finally ruled on our motion for reconsideration, that's when the issue of the offset was presented by the court saying, well, you know, it's still a net zero because of the offset issue. So we really didn't have an opportunity to...
I mean, I suppose you could have requested again to reconsider the reconsideration.
That's true. We could have done that, Your Honor. It seemed like it was a decided issue at that point. But and then as far as the equity issue...
Well, before you get there, can you also... Do you, in the spirit of concession, I suppose, you concede that the fact that the fact of denial was something that was not in the district court record?
No, I don't concede that because there was a lot of discovery. This was a UM claim, so everything was under the umbrella of Met Council, and they had all the bills. They knew nothing was paid. That was never in dispute, that none of the bills had been paid. So I do not think that they were unaware that there were no payments. And I think council's aware that Met Council wasn't paying anybody's medical in that window of time because of the reasons that he just brought up, which they were saying that they were not a motor vehicle under the statute. And so PIP or no fault didn't apply to Met Council.
Is there anything in the trial itself, testimony, documents that would suggest, apart from the trial, obviously if they had not denied the claim, you probably don't have a trial, right? But apart from the existence of the trial, is there anything in the record to support the fact of denial?
Yeah, there was a lot of documents, Your Honor, so I don't remember everything that exchanged hands. I don't know. Counsel said he didn't have access to the no-fault side of the case. I don't remember if that was accurate or not. But the bills on their face show what's paid and what's not paid. And the bills show if there's been payments, who makes the payments. Counsel was aware that... you know, these bills had been submitted to Met Council, and there's no evidence that Met Council made any payments on any of the bills. So I think that was very clear that there was a denial that my client was injured and that his injuries were as a result of this accident. Your Honor, if I may just address two more things. The equity issue, first of all. So you know, there's a big picture perspective on these cases. The defense is very aggressive in defending these cases, and I understand that. They'll spend a lot of money to defend. They'll spend far more money defending a case than the claim is even worth. You know, as I said, we made a Rule 68 offer for $4,000, which is significantly less than I'm sure was spent on their side. But the big picture is they aggressively defend cases because they want to dissuade or discourage people from making claims. And sometimes we don't feel it's appropriate or fair for them to deny claims. And so then we go to trial, and a lot of times I spend more money fighting a claim than the claim is worth because I don't think that what they're doing is fair. So that's the big picture. So to say, well, it's not equitable for you know, us to incur all these costs on a claim that only we're only $1,537 was awarded. Well, they made that decision. That was a decision they make. And, you know, as I said, they could, you know, there's a $4,000 offer, Rule 68 offer from our side. And that was obviously far less than what they ended up paying. So, you know, you have to put it in that context to decide the equitable issue. The, I guess my problem with the whole sending it back to the district court to decide who the prevailing party is, you know, I don't, first of all, I don't think the court has discretion when, or they abuse their discretion when they make a decision based on a misapplication or misunderstanding of the law, which clearly they are. I think even respondents' counsel is conceding that the district court judge made a mistake. And that was sort of the underlying foundation for why the district court said that defense was the prevailing party in this case. Second of all, as I said before, if you allow the judge...
Do we know that? I mean, that may be the basis, but do we know the district court would have reached that same conclusion if it hadn't made that error that you're referring to?
Well, that was the reason that the court gave.
No, we understand that, but if we remove that error... are we certain the district court would reach a different conclusion as to who the prevailing party is? And if we're not sure, why wouldn't a remand on that issue be appropriate? Because, and I'm sorry, I'm taking you over your time, but if Judge Bryan will allow you, you can respond.
Great, thank you. So I guess what I'm concerned about, Your Honor, is opening that door where you have the judge balancing all these unknown subjective issues to decide who the prevailing party is. I mean, that's gonna open the door to a lot of confusion and additional litigation, I think. There's that case Montgomery Ward versus Hennepin County. And in that case, you know, the court found that the judge abused discretion because they didn't apply a statutory test. In this case, there is statutory language that, you know, discusses, you know, who the prevailing party is or who's the winner on the underlying claim is when you get a verdict, and it's not zeroed out. So I think, you know, if once you go down the road of who really is the winner when you're factoring in all these thousands of variables, that's not a realistic good standard to give to courts. When I'm making a decision about litigating, it's helpful for me to have some clarity about how the system is going to treat my client depending on what they get. But if that's an unknown, if this cost issue is an unknown going in, so you say to me, well, at the end of the trial, your client might win on the underlying issue, but maybe they didn't get enough money to be the prevailing party. Well, what's enough money? Well, I don't know that yet. We'll figure that out at the end. I mean, that would not be a very good standard for litigants on either side.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brenningham and Mr. Brendel. We appreciate your arguments today and your well-written briefs. The matter is taken under advisement, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor.